Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with Ken Vincent of Waterford, Wisconsin. He's celebrating his 95th birthday this weekend, and there are 2 children, 5 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here to celebrate it with him if he hadn't survived some close calls in Europe during World War II with the 3rd Armored Division. Can you share some of those close calls with us, Kenny?
We were going up a draw one time, and I almost got myself court-martialed over this and came to a pillbox. And there's a little stubby gun sticking out of it. And I saw that bugger move. And I said, let's get the H out of here. And me over the side with my rifle. I no sooner hit the ground when the ground just shook. The half track came to a lurching stop. The left front wheel was blown completely off.
From that pillbox?
From that pillbox. Then the squad sergeant said, let's get out of here when it's almost too late.
And there were times where it wasn't just close in the guy to your left or your right is getting killed. There were times where you got pieces of shrapnel.
I had a couple pieces of shrapnel during the Battle of the Bulge penetrate my overcoat and the jacket I had underneath my overcoat, but didn't pierce. I didn't even know that I felt nothing other than the blow, but I just figured it was a stone or something, you know. And then pretty soon one of the guys said, hey, Vince, you had a piece of shrapnel sticking out of your coat. And he pulled it out, showed it to me, and I carried it in my pocket for a souvenir for a long time.
You didn't bring it home with you, did you?
No, I lost it someplace along the way.
How big was it?
Maybe about so big.
Maybe 3-4 inches?
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the Bulge. I've talked to so many guys who were there, and this is a huge, huge battle, thousands and thousands of troops, but the enemy that was shooting at you and many times was secondary to the enemy that was freezing your feet or your nose, your fingers. You're from here in the Midwest where you get snow every year. The winters are no joke in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Have you ever experienced anything like the weather during the Battle of the Bulge?
No, because in the Bulge we didn't have the clothes that we should have had. The rear echelon guys had the warm boots. We had just the regular combat boots that we always wore. The warmest thing we had was our overcoat.
And what were the conditions like that you were dealing with?
Oh, a snow on the level almost up to your knees in the open fields. I remember 3 days before Christmas, my outfit got cut off on the forward slope of a hill. There was a little village, little Belgian village, on this hill. Because we couldn't get our wounded out, we used the basement of the village tavern. I'll never forget Christmas Eve if I live to be as old as Methuselah. 3 times they sent their infantry in amongst the houses and into the houses.
The Germans did. And you guys are in these houses?
And yes, when we first went into the village, and by the way, there was nothing in this village, no furniture, nothing in these houses. And the people knew, well, in advance that the war was coming in their direction. So they took off with everything they could take. The first day, our combat engineers around the base of the village strung a tripwire with sea ration cans, a couple little pebbles in it, and grenades. And that night, when the Germans sent in their infantry the first time, it was great. They set off these grenades. But the second time, they tried to come in forcing a flock of sheep ahead of them.
They wanted the sheep to set any tripwires, huh?
Yeah. And the third time, they tried it themselves, but they were so decimated by that time. Evidently, we had figured out that this outfit was commanded by SS officers. Any unit that was commanded by SS officers fought to the death, practically.
Right. So the Germans keep coming and coming.
Until they used up the bulk of their manpower and finally gave up.
That must have been some hairy days for you, though.
Oh. See, I was, besides being a gunner on the mortar, I also was allowed to volunteer on rifle teams on our flanks. We always had a team out on each flank and one in the front, 2 guys in each team. Why I say that is that the very first day we were on the rifle range in basic training down at Camp Polk, We were given 5 rounds. And in a prone position, I put the first round just as it was touching the black, the other 4 right in through it. Near me were 2 officers. There were several of the guys laying in a prone position. One of the officers, who had a clipboard in his hand, walked up to where I was and he said, "Soldier, where did you learn to shoot like that?" And I said, "Squirrel hunting with my dad." And that's how I did learn. My dad taught me how to use the .22 when I was 9. He used to say, if you can't hit a squirrel in the head, you let him go. Because if that pellet goes through his body, sure, you may kill him, but that pellet chews up too many bones. And then when it's cooked, and my mom always made stew, then you got those bones in your mouth and those sharp little things. So my dad figured, if we can't hit him in the head, we let him go.
Yeah.
And I can remember to this day, hit him in the head.
So you demonstrated your marksmanship there,
yeah,
so they knew. But I thought the first rule of the Army was never volunteer for anything.
I didn't have brains.
So you volunteered.
I volunteered for something just for the excitement of it, I guess. I volunteered a couple of times to go out on a reconnaissance patrol at night. And both times I got myself lost.
You're lucky you didn't get yourself killed.
That's right. Because I lost contact with my contact man, and I don't have a good sense of direction. With a map and a compass, oh, you can't lose me. But I'll never forget that first time. What do I do? We were near some woods. A lot of the woods in Germany, in fact, I don't think I ever saw any that weren't artificially planted. I think all the natural timber had been long since used.
Right.
And the timber that they had was all nice, straight, even rows, you know. And any branches, anything that fell to the ground would be brushed up into piles and ultimately burned in people's stoves. Well, I found one of these piles and I crawled underneath the thing. Now, let me tell you, Paul, I'm not fooling. It's scary because GIs are noted to be hair, what's the word?
Hair trigger?
Trigger happy.
Trigger happy, sure.
And here this line of infantry with the tanks in between them coming my way, and I'm waving my helmet.
How long had you been hiding under there?
Hours.
So you got lost in the night and had to wait till morning?
That's right. I figured this is my only chance, you know, so that's what I did. The second time, I didn't volunteer. I was volunteered GI style. Vince, you and Johnson and so, you know. So, and I got lost then. Only that time, I found a foxhole. I'd often heard of foxholes being booby-trapped, so I remember taking my rifle and staying around on the edge as much as I could and moving my rifle around in that hole before I crawled down in it. And, you know, both times, my name was on the, not the honor roll, believe you me, it was on the morning report.
As missing?
Missing in action.
Uh-huh.
Well, the company commander wasn't too happy about that, because when I showed up, he had to go through the paperwork of changing it, you know.
On the cold at the Bulge, I mean, around Christmas there, you're holed up in that village, but were there other times where you had to sleep out in a frozen foxhole?
Oh, oodles of times.
And how did your fingers and toes and other extremities handle that?
Well, I lost my toenails. I wasn't hospitalized. I remember the medics just rubbing some ointment on it of some kind. I had 2 pairs of gloves. This is kind of dangerous doing this, but a lot of we guys did it. We call it liberating. We'd go into people's houses and go through their dresser drawers, finding things we could wear, socks as an example. I found something that fit over my head and buckled under here. At least my cheeks and were taken care of.
So kind of like a makeshift ski mask that you fashioned.
And the ski mask, yes.
Uh-huh.
Because, like I said, we didn't have clothing for that cold weather. And we didn't have the hot food.
You know, you get through the Bulge in January, but you still got another 4 months of fighting to go. You guys crossed the Ruhr River and the Rhine. Your division liberated Cologne.
We crossed at Bonn, which is a suburb of Cologne, between Cologne and the Rhine River. When you got to that point and looked over Cologne, all you saw was rubble, with the exception of one building that was left intact, the Cologne Cathedral.
Very famous images of that.
Yeah.
That had to make quite an impression on you to look out and see that.
It really did. By that point in time, I had seen so much destruction. It was common, like when we went into the Ruhr Valley shortly after we entered Germany, the cities and villages were leveled. I'll never forget looking down into the valley with binoculars and knowing that some of the factories were still being operated, but by slave labor, which we didn't know.
Right.
We thought it was Germans, you know.
Well, you mentioned that slave labor, and I've talked to some guys who are convinced some of those slave laborers saved their lives by sabotaging some of the artillery shells they were producing. You know, there were duds that would land near their hole, and they lived through that. There's so many different directions, fascinating history there. And in some of these factories and situations, that slave labor were people who had been put in concentration camps. Were you aware of what the Nazis were doing to the Jewish people and other prisoners?
No.
Hadn't heard anything about it?
No. We weren't aware of that until it just so happened that our column of vehicles was held up right at the main entrance of a concentration camp. It wasn't the kind that had, like, the ovens or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
These were political prisoners, but they all looked like walking skeletons, absolutely walking skeletons. And the stench was enough to gag a camel.
Mm.
And two or three of my buddies and myself walked right in the place, didn't go in any buildings, couldn't stand the thought of that. We thought we were pretty hard to a lot of things by that point in time. And the smell, I'd smelled death, but this was a not only that smell, but all the other odors mixed together.
Hmm.
A big, long, open ditch, and the dead each morning would be dropped in that ditch and then covered over with lime or sometimes earth. And so we guys stayed in for a little while. They were bringing up long lines of ambulances, trucks to transport the internees to wherever they were going to go. We thought, well, let's get out of the way.
You land in France, late June of 1944. The war ends in May of 1945, so that's a little shy of a year that you spent engaging the enemy. How long did it feel like?
Felt like an eternity at the time.
And out of all those situations, the extreme cold of the bulge, the artillery, the bombs, the small arms fire, everything you dealt with, is there one situation that when you reflect now you say, yeah, that was the closest. That was the closest call or the most fortunate situation I was able to survive?
Being cut off back in France on a rather steep hill, one of the things I remember was that everybody, no matter what your job was, had to empty out the ammo racks and naturally the mortars and bring them up to the top of the hill. There were some huge, huge boulders as big as rooms. We set up our mortars up there. We didn't need any forward observer, believe you me, because when daylight came, the Germans threw lines of infantry against us. It was almost like, what's that expression, shooting fish in a barrel, until we ran out of ammo. And we just had to sit and wait and hope. And then our tails were saved by, they were called P-38s.
Yeah.
They had the twin fuselage.
The Germans called it the fork-tailed devil.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And sounds like this is a situation where it earned that reputation.
We called it our own Air Force. The 3rd Armored Division had a squadron starting out the war with the P-38s. A little bit later in the war, it was the P-47s, and the P-38s were sent over to the Pacific. Then we ended up the war with P-51s. These P-38s had silver bodies, and I remember how they glistened in the sun, and they worked in pairs. The first pair had come down, strafed a tank to make sure that the tank stayed buttoned up, and then the second one would fall right behind with a pair of, those are heavier bombs, I don't know what their weight was, but they could literally tear a tank apart. And they strafed the infantry several times, and that was it.
And you told us you ran out of ammunition.
That's right.
You've got nothing else to do. The Germans are still coming.
The P-38s finished up the job.
But if the P-38s weren't there,
oh,
they're going to overrun you.
That would have been the end.
You would have either been a prisoner or you'd be dead.
Yep.
So I guess you like P-38s.
I sure do.
Can you describe for us what that feels like? To be basically helpless. You can't fire anything else at them. They're still firing at you. And then these planes come to your rescue. What did that feel like inside of you? What were the emotions that you experienced?
You want to jump out of your boots.
And you mentioned that when you headed over and you saw that Statue of Liberty, you wondered if you would see her again. Did you get to sail back into New York Harbor?
Yep, on the Queen Mary.
So you see her again coming back.
You bet.
And she kind of symbolizes everything you were fighting for, doesn't she?
You bet. Wonderful, wonderful feeling.
I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us these stories that only you could tell us.
You're welcome.
And I'd like to know, as you look back on it, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Yeah, I'm thankful I came back.
Aren't we all? That is Ken Vincent turning 95 this weekend. Happy birthday, Kenny. We enjoyed a long conversation, and some of it wouldn't fit into our radio time. So if you want to hear more, including his experience with Stars and Stripes Honor Flight out of Milwaukee, you can find all of that on the extended podcast version of today's episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.